Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Hildebrand Szilard from the Edgelord Investor. Welcome, Hildebrand. Would you like to introduce yourself briefly to the audience and describe what the Edgelord Investor is and where they can find it? I'm sure it's linked. I'll just make sure of that. But in the meantime, please introduce yourself.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Hildebrand Szilard. It's not my real name. It's not my first pseudonym, not the last one, probably. I am one of the administrators of the Edgelord Investor, which is a Telegram channel that is posting memes, but most importantly, it's posting the charts for traders and is posting some opinions, most commonly of my own, that are reflecting on the current economic situation and the what's awaiting us in the future.
And that can be, I have linked to that. It is on Telegram, and people, you know, some people will object to that, but I really think that people should be getting onto Telegram increasingly, because it is seeming like the only place left for freedom of speech, other than Gab, of course. And I don't mean to neglect Gab, because, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and even Medium.com, they are increasingly censorious, as we all know. So we don't need to go on about that. But Hildebrand, you came to my attention because a few months ago, somebody shared one of your articles in my group on Telegram, and it was from the Edgelord Investor, and it interested me greatly because you put in very clear terms, the topic was you believe there is an upcoming major economic depression on the way, and you put in very clear terms why you think that is the case, and I thought that was. It was good. It was clearly written, and you know, I'm not into economics. I'm not inclined. My mind isn't optimized for economics. It's not good at it. So it was good to read an article that I could follow, that I could understand. So obviously, this isn't going to be the most upbeat stream, but it might well be a necessary one for people. It might be things that people need to hear and understand so that they can prepare for the future. So Hildebrand, could you go into why you believe that we are heading into that a major economic depression is on the way?
Yeah. So let's jump straight in. The most evident cause for an upcoming economic depression is the aging of the population globally, not just in the United States or in Europe especially, but we are actually witnessing a very, very disturbing, I would say, trend that the birth rates are plummeting. And this path towards the depression is not exactly new. This trend was set up sometime, I would expect, let's say, if we estimate this conservatively, being a little bit more more optimistic, well, maybe somewhere around the great financial crisis of 2008, when we saw this strange situation emerging with the international governments all around the world imposing this concert of different legislations across the world to rein in the banking and financial industry. And that, on top of that, we entered this strange economy with negative zero interest rates across the world. And we also entered this strange situation where money is no longer being made on traditional investment, it's being made on speculation. And that is most importantly for the bond markets. Now, the depression signs are not just in the economics. Now, you mentioned very importantly that most of us are not economists. I am not an economist. I was going to a business school. I was studying there, but I never graduated with economics. I graduated with studying journalism. That's why I'm so good when it comes to, let's say, packing things and delivering them in simple terms. My other specification was in security, something not related to economics necessarily, but something we're seeing with the growing problem with the ease of transaction. This is something I noticed 10 years ago dealing with banks and bank transactions, basic, you know, sending a few dollars here and there, that every single movement you make nowadays attracts the attention of the banking hierarchy, the banking officials and the managers. They don't want you to keep money because of such low interest rates, and also there are fees involved. So in America you don't see that as much, but in Europe you do see that when you put money on your bank account, they charge you a fee, and that fee is higher than the interest they pay on your money. So essentially that's a negative interest rate implemented. Why do they do that? Because that money is not an asset for the bank. They don't use your money as an asset. They see your money as a liability. The assets are what? They are the mortgages that they give out. They are the loans they give out. And we entering a very strange situation where we have negative or almost negative interest rates, meaning that banks are encouraged to give out money, but that money is not being given out because they're too afraid to give out money. So it's like central bank is telling central banks, the Fed and the ECB and so on, the Bank of England, they're all telling the banks, look, we want you to give money, but the interest rates so the interest rates are low, so the only way they can make money is by giving the loans, but they still don't want to do that. It's creating a very strange situation. And now the unavailability of money to ordinary people. So if you want to take a loan, you're going to do that through a corporation, a big one, right? So let's say you have a very big company like JP Morgan and they want to take a loan. They can take a loan, no issue. But if you have a business, small business trying to take a loan, well, maybe they have a chance. They have chances, but if you're self-employed, maybe not. It depends. But that is what that means. The availability of money is dwindling, and as the availability of money is dwindling, people are thinking in economic ways. Even if they don't realize it, they say, "Well, I need to. Maybe we don't need to have the second baby. Maybe we don't need to buy that vacation. That hits consumption. That will lead to deflation." Now, deflation is a very right now everybody's crazy about inflation. There is a deflation debate, inflation, deflation, and so on. But we see a very obvious sign. If you look at the chart of the dollar, dollar has been winning against every single major currency out there. We see the Dixie, which is the index of dollar against the major currencies, a basket of currencies going up and up and up. And that is happening ever since around last this winter spring season. So somewhere around February, March, we saw this stop in the fall of the dollar that was saw in 2020. It was very spectacular. If you bet, let's say you bought Canadian dollars against US dollars, you were winning. You were making more and more dollars. If you kept your money in Canadian dollars, that stopped, actually reversed in 2021. It was exactly the same thing with yen. Yen was going up against the dollar in 2020. Now, ever since around February, dollar yen forex pair, it just skyrocketed up. And now here's a problem. We see these contradictions happening that people say, well, dollar is dying, inflation is everywhere. Yes, if you're an American, things that were normal for you before, now they cost much more, right? It's obvious there are supply chain issues. There are all kinds of problems with the availability of the staff and resources and things like that. And yet we see that there's a big hunger for the dollar. Why is that happening? There are many explanations. One of them was that I was talking about all these developing economies. They cannot issue bonds in their own currencies because nobody trusts them. Let's say you have, you saw what happened to Turkish lira, the national currency of Turkey, that it collapsed absolutely abysmally. Even though the Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, it went down in the recent weeks against the dollar, it's still up against lira because lira is so abysmally sold off. We see that these developing economies cannot issue bonds in the national currency, but they can issue euro bonds or they can issue dollar bonds. The problem is these countries do not print money. So what do they have? They have natural resources. How do they manage to pay off the bonds? They dig for the national resources, they sell them on international markets for dollars, they bring them back and they pay off the debt. That's how it works. Now, America has a unique position that is the only country where they can make dollars, right? Nobody can print dollars. Well, print, I'm using this term very vaguely. Nobody can create new dollars around the world except banks in the United States. But dollars are still very, very heavily required by economies all across the world. And now you see declining population, you see this hunger for dollars, it is going much higher than expected. Now, it is not unexpected if you were studying these things for the past, let's say, 10 years. But ever since 2008, what seems to me is that we were living this illusion of growth and inflationary expansion. And now it is as if we cannot go further with this narrative. We cannot tell, the Fed cannot tell everybody that, okay, you know, that we're going to keep the interest rates low because we want credit to flow and the economy to expand, new businesses to open, services to be provided. Because even with all this accommodative sort of approach, they try to help the economy by creating this illusion of growth. That is no longer working. People are no longer being employed. They no longer see that. This is exactly opposite of what we saw in 2019, one of the best economies under Trump in the United States. And I visited New York back a few years ago before the insanity began. And yeah, you could say that the country was almost flourishing, I would say. Yeah, it was flourishing, even though it was New York and it was a Democrat city, but the economy was flourishing. And now we see that this was almost as if that was an illusion. And now,
so, go ahead. That was 2 years into Trump's presidency, halfway through his presidency. So, mm-hmm. And also 10 years after the global financial crisis of 2008. Mm-hmm. So, and that was when the banks were bailed out, which was an unprecedented move at the time. The amounts of money involved were huge at the time. I believe that the U.S. debt is now vast, like much larger than the amounts of money that were involved in that banking bailout back then. So if they were to bail out the banks now, it would be like 10 times as much or something. I can't remember what it was that I read, but I read that the situation is just much more serious than it was in 2008.
Exactly. And it is much more serious. And one of the topics that I covered in the Edgelord Investor was why did the pandemic happen? And one of the, let's say, financial economic conspiracy theories. Why was it okay? Why did they declare a pandemic? Well, one of the conspiracy theories around the whole thing. Well, I wouldn't call it conspiracies. It's a speculation.
Yeah, an explanation. Yeah.
The first signs of a problem started appearing in September 2019. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was the repo market issue. So I'm not going to go into what repo market is. There are plenty of people who will describe this. But the problem is, so banks loan money to each other to keep each other alive overnight. These are overnight operations. They need to lend money, loan and lend money. Yeah. So basically, it's about repurchasing. So if you like lend money against a collateral, then you repurchase it. It's. I'm not going to go inside it, but the point is they need to have some pristine collateral, and that pristine collateral against which you borrow money is treasury bills. Treasury bills are basically, they are debt instruments printed by the treasury that are like a few months. And you basically get paid interest on a very, short term debt. It's like a bond that is that lasts you for a couple of months, maybe a year, something like that. So these are the treasury bills are very good because if you default on the loan, you don't give the money back. You still have these treasury bills, and the treasury will pay you back in dollars in the Federal Reserve notes, right? So that is the logic of this repo market. And what was happening is that banks stopped lending, and how we could tell that they stopped lending is because they started charging higher interest on this repo market. And that created a problem that banks stood to halt and said, wait a minute, we can't finance our overnight operations. We cannot, you know, get the money to pay everybody to keep lights on the next day. So the Fed rushed in, they had a facility open, they basically bailed them out again. And then they went silent with it for a few months. I think it came back around November. That's October or November. That is when I made some money on gold, gold futures, not physical gold. I'm not talking about that. And then it went all silent, and suddenly pandemic happens. we get all this news from China and so on. So that's like one explanation why they went with the whole thing. But it
A minute. That would be a controlled demolition of the economy in order to, what?
Oh, yeah. And we see something interesting happening. If you look at FRED, which is a St. Louis Fed statistics site, you can see that after 2020, in 2020, we see an unrestricted credit expansion. And at the same time, you see something correlating with it. That's Vanguard and BlackRock are buying up real estate, residential real estate. So that is one of the signs that things are getting out of control. They're letting these big investment firms, investment managers, to buy up huge amounts of property. And the way they do that is the Fed basically tells banks, you have to lend them money. You have to give them money. They ask for loans, you give them. That's the point. That's the point of having like zero interest rate. They encourage. But who do they lend the money to? Not the average Joe who had his store burned in Minneapolis, right? In these horrible riots. No. That was these big investment managers, big investment firms. BlackRock is managing trillions of dollars worth of funds. The way they work, so if you don't want to buy stocks, what do you buy? You buy exchange-traded funds, or you go with mutual funds. But the most typical way, you want to buy something on the market. So you buy S&P 500 invested ETF, right? Exchange-traded fund stock, right? That way you secure investment, you diversify it. And who manages that? BlackRock through its iShares instruments. Vanguard has the same thing, even though Vanguard is not publicly traded, but BlackRock is. So they use these things. Now, ETFs are going insane. Right now we have what they call the leverage ETFs. So if, let's say, the symbol TQQQ or something like that, you can buy the exactly same ETF, like you want to invest into NASDAQ 100, so you buy them, but you want to, you think NASDAQ will go up, so you buy triple leveraged ETF. This way, you don't have to go into debt on opening a leverage position. It means you don't have to borrow directly from the broker. You just buy the one share of the ETF. If it goes down, you still keep it. If it goes up, you can sell it. It doesn't matter. But this ETF insanity is starting out to be quite noticeable. And who are the culprits? Vanguard and BlackRock, these two big investment managers. Goldman Sachs has, I think, its own. So you see all of these guys going up. And this creates this illusion of inflationary expanse that, okay, economy is expanding, S&P 500 goes up, everybody's happy. But look at what I said about the DXY, the US dollar index. It went flat when it stopped falling back in February, March. And now the same thing happened with Russell 2000, which is, I would argue, a better representative of the United States economy than S&P 500, because not as much money goes into that. And it stopped this. It's like negatively correlated. The dollar goes up and the Russell 2000 goes down. Why is that? Because all these companies take loans. They have to pay them back. One of the ways you pay back a loan, you bet that the currency will go down in value. If the currency goes down in value, hey, you take a loan. You don't need to worry about it because your collateral, whatever you own, a house, a car, whatever, it will go up in value against the US dollar. So if you need to sell, you sell. But right now, we see what's happening with the deflationary pressures. If money is getting more and more expensive, less available, you will have to sell your stuff to get that money to pay back all your debt. And when that happens, the deflationary debt spiral begins. And that's what's the big looming problem with the West. There's not enough dollars in the system. And when we say, well, dollar is dead, it's not dead because there's too many dollars. It's dead because it's becoming unobtainium. It's becoming scarce. And no matter what the Fed does, it disappears into some black hole and nobody knows where it goes. And that's the problem with the Fed itself, that in the United States, the Fed back in 2000, Alan Greenspan said, basically, we don't really know how to define money. So the question is, if you don't know how to define money, how the hell do you print money? And I don't credit me with these words.
Alan Greenspan.
Yeah, as told to the public in recent months and recent years by, what's his name? Anyway, yeah, whatever. Let's move on.
I'd like to go through the points that you made in the article that I read. and mm-hmm. because these are more tangible things that I think people will be able to understand who aren't into economics, who don't understand all of that terminology so much, because the points that you raised here were far more accessible. So I'll go into these. You said there's a piling up of evidence of an upcoming economic depression, and pieces of the puzzle fit together quite neatly. And the first thing you mentioned was mass exits of the labor force from essential mm-hmm. spheres that are tasked with maintaining a functioning economy and steady population growth: nurses, police, and firemen. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to disclose where I am, but I am in Europe. Okay, and we are seeing in the European Union, to be precise. What we're seeing is that there is a growing pressure that they're going to vaccinate the nurses, they're going to vaccinate the firefighters, the police, and so on. And there are fears, and very tangible fears, among all these ruling elites that they can lose up to one-tenth, let's say, hypothetically, up to one-tenth of the police force when that happens. Okay, maybe it's fine if it's happening, I don't know, in Poland, right? But if it's happening in France, where you have whole cities, in inner cities, whole areas that are uncontrollable, and now the police is not able to prevent all these, let's say...
I understand, and my audience will understand what you're
saying. Yeah, fringes of society from leaving those places and starting trouble in the, let's say, upper class areas, right? It's what we saw in America, in Washington, in Minnesota, and so on. We saw these gangs of idiots with the Black Lives Matter signs coming to suburbs and creating problems there. That's not good, because you're targeting the backbone of the country. Now, when that happens, yeah, okay, in America it's going to be idiotic. It's going to be somewhere. It's going to be riots. Somewhere it's going to be mass burning of businesses, or just a gay fucking, sorry for the words, protest. But in Europe, it's going to end in bloodshed, inter-ethnic violence. Do we really want that? Now, when it comes to other essential professions, this is even more important, in my opinion. Fuck the cops. Who cares? You know, they can replace them with the UN troops, because it doesn't take much brains, you know, to be a cop. But if you're a plumber, and there are not a lot of plumbers, electricians, not a lot of electricians, all of them are boomers who studied this stuff 30 years ago. They've been doing their private self-employment gig for maybe 20 years, right? Now they're retiring. And now... they're giving a choice. So you can no longer go to a bar to, have a drink. Well, maybe they expanded. You can no longer go to any venue to do anything, including repairs, unless
actually,
you're vaccinated.
I even heard that butchers, apparently nobody wants to be to go into that trade anymore. Nobody, like young people, don't want to become butchers. And it's all old people. It's dominated by people who are on the verge of retirement.
Exactly.
And apparently, this is in Britain. And it's also the same with farming, because being a farmer is difficult. It's not an easy job. And apparently there, again, it's dominated by older people. And they are on the verge of retiring, or they're
exactly.
approaching retirement. So, these are obviously essential trades here. And then nurses... again, with COVID, there's been an increase in people leaving the nursing vocation. And so you've got people leaving these jobs. I don't know what they're going into. Maybe they're on welfare. I'm not sure. But either way, the vaccine, and it's strange because a large percentage of the population are vaccinated, at least in Britain. And I know it's the same in the Netherlands and Germany. Mm-hmm. But still, it's enough people are left, are still unvaccinated and don't want to get vaccinated and are in these jobs and are leaving these jobs, that
yep.
it's enough that it's causing a problem, or definitely a potential problem in the near future.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. I will add more. It's not just the vaccine. It's the vaccine passports. It's the paperwork. It's the stress of, people are now afraid to talk with their colleagues about stuff because of this this insanity in the air, this fear-mongering. There's lots of cooling effects or chilling effects in journalism. The chilling effect is when some action takes place and now suddenly everybody shuts up. Nobody talks about what needs to be said. Nobody's saying what needs to be said. So, you know, the point is, people are stressed not just because of the virus or because of the vaccine. They're stressed because of the reaction to all that. And you can have a population of mega vax, triple booster, whatever, and they will say, I quit, because they cannot deal with the stress at work. That's it.
Yeah. To have a simple life is... It's no longer as easy as it once was. Even a fairly straightforward job that should be fairly straightforward is now rife with speech protocols, rules, bureaucracy that people increasingly don't understand and are overwhelmed by. If we move on to the second point you made, collapse, and it's kind of related to this, collapse of trust in government institutions and more importantly in police, tasked with keeping the general peace, and courts tasked with upholding justice. So collapse of trust in government institutions, police, and courts.
Oh, yeah. So recently in Europe, there were several elections, and none of the parties in several countries that was heavily against all these lockdowns got any form of a meaningful representation, I would argue. But the point is, so you cannot change anything with parliament. You cannot, you go vote and suddenly you realize that your guys aren't going in. Okay, you lose faith in the whole system. Then, okay, I trust the police because I want to go out and I want to know that they will guard me. They will protect me from looters. And suddenly, this has been actually happening in America for a while. I'm talking about US because I'm an English speaker, but whatever. We saw ever since Obama and before Obama, there were cases of mass riots, especially by the black people, in places like Philadelphia, and cops were nowhere to be seen. We saw that in Minneapolis. We saw that in Seattle. We saw that everywhere. Cops aren't doing their jobs. And the reason why they aren't doing their jobs can be it's political. Could be they're afraid either of political consequences or the physical confrontation. Could be either. Or they're afraid of going to jail, like happened with Derek Chauvin, who, you know, caused the whole George Floyd insanity, and allegedly. And, you know, what I'm saying is, so these guys are trusted with protecting the public, and now they do not protect the public. And moreover than that, what they do, they will go and check the pubs that you have your COVID passport. What the hell is this? Right?
Yeah,
do you trust
absolutely.
The police after that? And then they say, well, we don't have a choice. No, you have a choice, motherfucker. You have a choice. You guy at the end of it, so Solzhenitsyn wrote about it. He said, Stalin did not kill everybody with his hands. Not a single person was killed by Stalin, probably, ever in his life. But all these mass murders that happened because these people are on the ground, in boots on the ground, were shooting people, they were ordering people, and they were beating people. None of the worst atrocities in human history happened because some guy with a hat said so. No, it happened because the people with the gun decided to pull the trigger. That's it. No alternative. So when people say, well, bad apples, good apples, I'm saying it's not about apples. These are robots. These are Zogbots, as some people call them. You know, I'm not into conspiracies, but that's the term they use. Those are robots. They are tasked with the thing. And I sympathize, you know, with all these people having nervous breakdowns because they cannot do their job. I sympathize, but look, you can always leave so far. You're not a slave, right?
Well, that would explain point one. That's why
exactly,
they are leaving.
Exactly. They're leaving. And, you know, this is unprecedented. Now, how do we, how do they, you know, the elites, whoever, deal with this? So far, I don't see any solution. But yeah, trust in courts. Look at what's happening with these vax mandates being challenged with courts. That even in some countries, courts are siding with the plaintiffs. They're saying, no way, we cannot allow this insanity to happen. Governments just evade. They just evade. They change the wordings of their documents. They say, okay, this law, this regulation, this mandate is no longer valid, but we're going to make a new one in the next 24 hours. That's it. How can you trust courts if courts can't rein the governments in? You cannot. So no police, no courts, no government, no parliament. Parliament will not protect you either. Look at Britain, right? So now Britain is facing a vax mandate from the same person who promised that there's going to be no mandate, or at least the political party. Now they have lost all credibility, in my eyes, at least the Conservative Party and all these people. But look at what they're doing. They are passing all these laws and all these regulations designed to keep the pandemic on. And let me remind you, the World War II regulations in the UK, those that are now, you know, obsolete, they were still on and active long after the war ended. And after 1945, you had about 25 years or 30 years of peace until they finally rescinded some of the regulations. You couldn't get money out of Britain. You were basically a slave if you were a working class Briton, right? And only during Thatcher they managed to scrap some of that. Now, I don't know. It doesn't seem that all this COVID insanity, this pandemic legislation is going away, and there's no hope in the institutions.
No, I was reading an article on UK Column just earlier today that was going into all of this, how the coronavirus emergency legislation, the emergency state that the country is in because of COVID, is renewed every year. And hardly any politicians were even there this time when it was voted for it to be renewed. They're not involved in the process. They don't care
at all.
They're just waving this stuff through. And that emergency legislation, that emergency state, allows the government to do all sorts of things, and it allows them to suspend the right to protest, the right to do various things. And of course, it also leads to online censorship as well. So it's a very important thing, and yet the politicians don't even care to vote on it. They just allow it. They just look the other way. So that's a collapse of trust in the government institutions. Yeah, absolutely. I think that very few people at this point have much trust in national governments. I mean, that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but I definitely think that trust has declined, even though people still follow the mandates and the directives from the government and the laws. I think that the institution of government has suffered as a result of the last 2 years. Point three, culture struggle or Kulturkampf, spilling over to engulf the majority of the population. What used to be the domain of online discussion by 2019 grew into violent protests and occasional insane policies by select universities. Today it kicked off as a vaccine debate and now threatens cohesion in workplaces where politics used to play little or no role normally. Everything has become politicized, especially because of COVID, but not just COVID. I mean, also the what people call woke politics, wokery.
Oh,
yeah. Everything has become politicized. So yes, culture struggle is no longer something that is just in 2015, it would be on a YouTube channel like mine, the SJW channels or whatever. It's now just everywhere. I mean, no normie can escape this stuff anymore. Not just the effects of it, but even the preaching and all this constantly.
Yeah, and this is very worrying because now you have mandatory woke trainings in the corporations. And look, before this thing happened, it was like, okay, you just sit, click through it, keep it on mute and forget about it just for the things. But now they're going deep into this. They have classes where they invite people to write and all that bullshit. Honestly, bullshit, because look, I studied these things. I know postmodernism and all that philosophy shit. I know it. It was part of my diploma thesis that I used to write. It's fine. I get it. But you take this to people who never heard about this crap. And essentially what you're doing, you're brainwashing them because they don't know how to respond to this. They don't understand that they're being manipulated. They don't understand that all this crap about race, it's essentially a form of exploitation. It's a form of, how can I say it? Manipulation. That's what it is. It's a manipulation.
I think you're
brainwashing,
right.
Yes.
That's a really interesting point, that when very intelligent and curious, intellectually curious people read about these things and discuss these things, it's actually a discussion. It's actually an exploration of the issue and or the issues. But when average people are subjected to this stuff, they don't have the mental apparatus to question it or to explore it. They just absorb it. It just becomes brainwashing. It just becomes propaganda because they exactly. can't question it. They can't resist it.
Exactly. And this is the same thing that you see with universities. Why are universities becoming so woke? I will answer you why, in my opinion. They're becoming like this because everybody is going to the university and everybody is most likely to be a conformist. Most likely. Most people are likely to be conformistic and they are likely to follow whatever crap that their teachers are saying because they're like that. And that's what happens when you have mass education. Why public education is a failure in general, in my opinion, because everybody goes through it and it becomes that everybody is being dumbed down by it because everybody's dumb. Most people are dumb, let's say, but most people are dumb. They will not receive any sort of improvement from being stuck with other dumb people and being told what to do. That's not what happens. You tell dumb people what to do, the problem is they will never figure out what really needs to be done. That's the like the essence of education. You go back to Socrates with this stuff. You know, do I teach someone or do I just give someone hints and they realize what's happening? That was like the big question in these like Socratic writings. And the problem right now, this Kulturkampf, this war between people about cultural stuff, transgenderism and all that nonsense, that absolutely non-medical, non-scientific nonsense that is now threatening everybody. If you say something lewd or something weird or something that's been construed as lewd or weird at work. And look, I used to work in 50-50% male-female collective. It's a hellhole, complete hellhole. You cannot do anything. You cannot construct anything. Everybody takes things personally. There's a chatter everywhere. Men take it personally. Women take it personally. It's absolutely undoable. The work becomes absolutely undoable. Now, what is happening now is that they take the HR and the training managers. They take this whole thing to a new whole level by introducing politics. Before that, it was just a snide comment. Now it's a political statement, right? Now you are becoming the devil in the eyes of your colleagues because you say something and not something else. That is very, very dangerous. You have a collective of 12 people. Let's say you're a manager. You need them to work cohesively. And now suddenly they start discussing race and turns out, you know, three of them are, I don't know, French and two of them are Italian and one is a guy from Angola. What the fuck? You know, now they all hate each other because the French hate the Italians and the Italians hate the Angolan guy for some reason. I have no idea what's going on. I don't care. I want the work to be done, the job to be finished, but it's not being done and the job is not being finished. And these people are leaving because they hate each other. See? And that is the problem. We cannot allow, let's say, I don't like to say we, but I cannot allow my staff to be divided along these things. If I have a business, if I have a, not even a business, I have a project at a company, big S&P 500, whatever. I have a project. I have a team. I need to cooperate with the client and with the stakeholders involved, people above me, salespeople who want to make sure they sell a project and for a big client, they pay big money and everybody's happy, right? If my project is not going well, the cavalry will rush in and ask, what the hell is going on? And we're going to fire you because you didn't do your job. We're going to find someone else. And then you go to the HR and ask, okay, find me people. And they don't do their job because they're all woke. They're all brainwashed. Why? Because HR departments are filled with women who are college educated. Now, the old generation of the HR women, you know, women in their like 50s, they're now leaving. And now they're being replaced by these new graduates in their 20s and 30s. And all these people are brainwashed. All these women are brainwashed. See, HR generally, traditionally, being a women's department in general. Now, it looks like they like their power, that the power of to fire anyone they like. You know, I imagine their tone of the voice when they talk, and it's nauseating, really. And I'm not saying this to shit on the HR people, but I'm telling them, look into what you're doing if you're really helping the company, because essentially the goal of the HR is not to be kind to you. They're not there to be a mummy who will protect you from from big, nasty, evil coworkers who are making bad comments. No, their goal is to protect their company. If they have to fire you because you made a comment about a woman, they will fire you in a in a moment.
Yes.
They will retire you and they will make sure you never find a job again. They will just do that. That's why it's so dangerous now. And that's a part of the Kulturkampf that we're discussing.
Yeah, and that leads on to the next point, which is mass exodus of men from college campuses. Also from the workplace, but especially from college campuses. Women will not be able to fill in the gap, and the general appeal of college keeps declining as women who come out of these institutions are unable to form productive family units with men who have opted out of the college system because the woman is more educated, or will definitely see herself as more educated than the man. So she will be wearing the trousers in the relationship. This has serious implications for the long term, including birth and marriage rates.
Yep.
I think this is fairly self-explanatory, but would you like to go into it anyway?
Just quick note that, yes, women are now outpacing men. People are celebrating it. There's nothing to celebrate because these women will never find a husband. I can guarantee you they will never find a husband if there's not enough men to equalize the numbers, right? They will never, never marry down, because it means that they have to settle down. By the time they realize they need to settle down, they'll be too old to produce children without any negative complications. And that's a big, big, big problem, because women's reproductive age, even though modern medicine is doing miracles to advance it, it's still highly limited. So into that first 20 years of a woman's life, that's the most crucial part. By the time they reach 30, their reproductive chances are being dramatically decreased. And this is a big issue. The Chinese are realizing it. I'm not going to sing odes to the communists in the Chinese government, because I know whatever they're doing is failing. The Chinese people will not suddenly miraculously reproduce themselves just because the party ordered them. This is never going to happen. In the Soviet Union, this is very important. We need to look at the lesson of the Soviet Union. So in the Soviet Union, they had very liberal, surprisingly, very liberal marriage legislation, and the same thing on abortion and single motherhood. We saw that. I am from the Soviet Union originally, and we saw that the rate of single motherhood was absolutely astonishingly high, even compared with Europe by 1990s in the former Soviet Union. The absent father problem is still a big issue. I have hardly met any single person from the country I was born in who had a father at home. And that's one of the consequences of the socially liberal policy when it comes to divorces and abortion and so on. It's a big, big, big mistake to legalize these things and make them available on a whim, right? There is no way this can be, if you want to have children that will continue, move on, move this sort of generations on and on and on, you need to stop this shit. Pandering to women and so on. But the problem is women are creating votes, and whatever women want, politicians are ready to deliver.
Well, exactly. No matter what. I mean, from the time that women got the vote, government had to placate women, had to placate female voters. And of course, men want to placate women. There's a thing in our nature that we want to make women happy. So we give in to them. It's often the path of least resistance, and it's often what we think will make them happy. But the long-term results, because women can make bad choices, so the long-term results can be disastrous. And I think with women having the vote, politics, governments have to placate them with welfare programs, with speech protocols in the workplace, by encouraging businesses to take them on, by encouraging universities to take them on, as we were saying. And all of this is to placate the female voter, because the female voter is now a thing, and if you don't placate her, you will lose half of the population.
Exactly.
In terms of votes. So it's disastrous, because it leads to these things like women wanting careers, and women being told that they should want careers, women being told that they shouldn't want to settle for motherhood and having three kids by the age of 30. They shouldn't even be thinking about kids until they're 35. I mean, this kind of utter insanity has been enabled and is now the norm. And I think that there is, at least multiple generations of women who are just doomed. because they're going to realize at 40, oh my God, I'm never going to be a mother. I'm never going to be a grandmother. I have this career, but that career isn't going to lead to little grandchildren at my feet when I'm 70. They're going to be alone when they're 70. I mean, no family at all. It's just, it's terrible. It's absolutely awful with the trick that's been played on them here.
Exactly. And look, a woman can plan this stuff. You don't have to be a genius. If let's say a listener of ours is a woman, okay, here's your path. You're going to grow up, leave school. You need to find marriage. You need to produce kids. Then by the time you're, I don't know, the kids are 7, 8 years old. So let's say by 35, you give your kids to your grandparents, and grandparents will take care of them for the rest of their lives until they graduate school. Now is your time to go and find a job, an opening. Maybe you can go, entry level, but now you're free from the kids that you have produced. You have done your duty. Now you can focus on career and making money with your husband and prepare for the retirement. You don't need to sacrifice your whole life to kids. There's no need to do that. Now they're being told insanity. They're being told that, okay, these are the best years for your reproductive opportunity, and you're wasting them on a career. Are you kidding me? By the time you realize you need a family, you won't be able to reproduce. You won't be able to produce kids. That's something that women intrinsically should be aware of, because if one thing
I think intrinsically they are aware of.
Oh yeah, they should
but
be.
But it's brainwashed out of them.
Yeah, and that's it for this point, really, that women are leaving. And the problem is that they will not marry younger men. Men who are below their education level. Doesn't matter. They will still keep moving on until they find some. They realize what's happening and they settle. And when they settle, it breeds enmity and hate. So when a woman settles with a man who's below her in her eyes, she hates him. That's it.
Yeah,
there's nothing to
she
add.
Despises and resents him.
Exactly.
Because she feels that, it doesn't need to be explained, really. The next point is, you've largely gone into it already. Government policies created these problems, and they will try to solve them by promoting birth rates and flooding single women with cash per every newborn baby. But this will only exacerbate the issue. Similar policies were tried in the communist era in the Soviet Union, but they only backfired, creating several generations of single mothers and increasing poverty instead of population.
Exactly.
Expect such initiatives to become more commonplace. The result will be worse than the root cause. We are already seeing failed attempts of this in a few European countries. Would you like to go into that? Because I think I don't know about that, and I suspect a lot of people don't.
There is a misconception that if you financially incentivize women to produce kids, it will result in higher birth rates, and it will kind of raise the status, the financial status, the conditions of women. But the problem is, let's say you have a single woman. Let's take an anecdote. You have a single woman who wants money. So she has unprotected sex with several men, and then throughout the years, she spawns several children. Those children will be on government welfare. She will be on government welfare, and she will be alone. There will be no man. Now, who do you bring into the world when you're a single woman? Will you bring criminals, potentially? Actually, listeners can look it up. Criminals are much more likely. I'm talking about petty criminals, gangsters, thieves, murderers, robbers, all these people. They are much more likely to come from a single household than, and that should be a single mother household, because the figure of the father is very, very important in controlling all these impulses that they have. And the mothers are selfish in that aspect. They do not have any control, because look, in societies in general, especially in the West, they're very tolerant of women acting up. Okay, you are unlikely to find a case when a woman yells at a man and she gets shot in the face. That's not going to happen, most likely. Sometimes it may happen, but it's rare. It's much more likely to happen that a woman, that a man will be shot in the face for a threatening pose, right? Something like that, because women don't do a good job threatening men, at least physically. Same thing with, you can even notice this, when women go on to protests, right? They're, I would argue, less likely to get slapped by a cop than a man, and less likely to be handcuffed and arrested than a man, because man is simply physically much more threatening to another man than a woman. Now, the policies that are being implemented by these governments, they're saying, well, we will pay you this amount of money if you have a child. So what it led in the Soviet Union, I will give you a real example. In the Soviet Union, right when this whole thing was starting, when they had these socially liberal policies and so on, they wanted to implement a childlessness tax. So it means that if you don't have a child, you will have to pay a tax. Soviet Union collapsed, it disappeared, and the people, the population in the Soviet Union also diminished. The only exception for that were the Central Asian republics, where people were relatively poor, and these were relatively underdeveloped areas. And what happened afterwards is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, all these republics, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, the Kyrgyz Republic, and so on, they started producing massive amounts of people who didn't have a job. So what they did, they all started mass migrating to Russia, which is now creating big problems. That in Russia, you have young people who are unemployed, and they cannot find a job working as a, I don't know, at a construction site because all the construction positions are filled by the Tajiks. Now, that's not the fault of either the Tajiks or these nice young Russian guys. That's the fault of the I would say the elites in Russia, who are much more eager to hire somebody they don't need to pay any money, literally, or right than to go and hire some go to some official contract with someone who is an individual and they have to follow the labor code and pension plans and so on, this and that. Now, what does that produce? It produces the desire of the younger generation of Russians to leave the country. They don't want to live there. They want to leave. They want to go whatever, to United States, to Australia, to Europe. They want to go to Japan. There's actually in the east, far east of Russia, there's a big community of people who decided to move to Japan, where they have relatives in Japan and so on. So population is still diminishing, and I have heard back in 2000s how, you know, on Russian TV that they're going to implement the family plans for single mothers, so they're going to pay mothers to get the money. What happened since then? The value of ruble collapsed, and whatever money they used to pay, it's worthless. And now nobody's even talking about this because it's too embarrassing to even bring this up, right? Same thing you see in Europe. There was child welfare. I will give you one example. In Finland, they had it was the first country in Europe to have child welfare, and they would provide free stuff like toys and I think something like that to the Finnish young mothers as early as 1930s. Now, do Finns have higher reproductivity rate, let's say in the birth rates? No, not necessarily. That's not happening. You cannot pinpoint one single reason for all these things, but one category of reasons, let's say, of the culprits would be government policies, that they are not helping. They are producing an opposite effect. And you might ask, okay, what government policy is kind of causing people to have less kids? A very simple example, taxes. Now you say, okay, but they get fewer taxes because they have kids. Fine, but now they need to pay extra for the kids' education. They need to pay extra for the health of the children. They need to pay extra for all of this stuff. Now, if you're, I don't know, 25-year-old Finn, and you look at this stuff and you say, well, I already pay a lot of taxes and I get nothing. Now I have to pay even more for kids to pay for the education. Now, think about it differently. When you have children in the West, and not just in the West, in general, in modern, like welfare state, in modern state in general, you will go to jail if you don't send them to school. Literally, you will go to jail, and if you don't send them, if you don't, let's say, confirm necessarily, you say, okay, I'm going to send to private school. That's not going to help you because now you're going to pay even more for not sending them to a public school. And in public school, the kids will be brainwashed and they will be technically taken away from you because now you're not in control of they're being taught. And if you're not in control of your children at that early age, what is the motivation for you to have a child, right? What if they, so how
Yes,
can you rely?
because it's not somebody that you're shaping, which is the whole point of parenting. It is to transmit your values down into the next generation. If you're not even allowed to do that, then
Exactly. And I'm telling people, don't hope that, well, we'll change the government. Look, these things don't work that way. Governments don't like change with a coup. It's one layer laid over another layer. Same with laws. They have some abortion laws and they're going to make them obsolete. To make them obsolete, they will have to enact new law. Same thing that happened with let's say, with happens with immigration laws. So they say, well, we need to change the immigration laws. You do not change the laws. You enact new laws to affect the previous laws. But now here's the problem. What happens with the new laws is that people are too lazy. Let's say parliamentary members of the parliament, they're too lazy to make a new law. So what they do, they amend the laws. And when they amend the laws, they do it crudely, right? That's why you now have an insane situation that illegal immigration is basically unrestricted, but legal migration is impossible. How does that happen? That happens due to the legal this layering of legal standards that some parties make illegal immigration stricter, but that's the immigration they can control. And illegal immigration is now becoming unrestricted because the police and the border control people, they're not able to operate in the illegal sphere because they are all regulated by the legal body of laws, right? The only people who can operate in the illegal are probably people like CIA, intelligence people, but they're not tasked with preventing illegal immigration. They're tasked with, I don't know, fighting terrorists, spying, in the
going on abroad. To Telegram.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, there's a whole legal structure in place that it's very difficult to tackle. So when people talk about, well, we'll just change the law, I think that they really underestimate how difficult basically impossible it would be to do that. It requires a mass change of culture so that the culture would then be sympathetic to different laws. Otherwise, you're pissing into the wind, so to speak. Okay, so if we move on to point six, understaffed and generally unfit military and border control forces. Now, yep. One obvious example of this, which had just happened when you wrote this post on Telegram a few months ago, was the Afghanistan withdrawal. The American forces withdrawing from Afghanistan, the American authorities withdrawing from Afghanistan. I don't know if you would see that as an example of this. I think it is. I think that the US military is now unable to project physical real world force in a foreign territory because it's so infested with feminism and wokery and just the complete unrealistic mindset of the modern humanities graduate. Those are now the people shaping policy at the ground level, and they're completely unfit for they don't know what they're dealing with anymore. That's one aspect of military unfitness. Perhaps you'd like to go into this more generally.
I am a big student of history. I have read tens of thousands of pages of the Cambridge history of modernity and of the medieval, of the antiquity and so on. I'm a big fan of Osprey series, this British publisher that is publishing these very nice books about, with nice illustrations about the military equipment and so on. And also, I'm a very, very concerned with the state of the Western military, because what we're seeing is that... In Afghanistan, what we saw was a complete fiasco, obviously, and that's the result of, in some very, I would say, esoteric way, not going into supernatural, but sort of a, if you look at, feel sort of the atmosphere, you know, it's like, it's a reflection of what was happening since 2008, that this economic degradation brought cultural degradation, and that spilled over into the military, which is now being degraded, you know, and the problem with the military in the West is that they're not just in the West, actually. There's a big problem. One other example I bring is Russia, because Russia has mandatory service. There's a big culture of dodging it, actually. And I'm not going to say where I'm from, but where I'm from, it was also the case. And I managed to dodge it by immigrating and studying. So there's a joke back from the Soviet Union, I think, or like early days of the independence. The collapse of the Soviet Union was that there are so many educated people thanks to the military, because you have to serve by the age before you hit the age of 27. If you're a male, you have to go to the military and you have to serve 1 year. It used to be 2 years in the Soviet Union, so almost every male used to go to serve the military. Once you finish your service, you get the military passport, and that military passport allows you to go to work in the police or in the government and so on. If you don't have it, it's much more difficult. Now, in Russia, there was a big problem in the past 20 years that the population is diminishing and the fitness of the men is becoming less and less suitable for the military. And this problem is now facing the West as well. And I think it's getting more and more exacerbated because, as I said, in Russia, they faced all these problems with the decline of the population, the single motherhood, the criminality, absolutely insane. Like everybody was in jail or had their relative in jail. And in America, it's happening only now, right? At least among the whites. It's different among different racial demographics, but in Russia, it was general for most people. And what we're witnessing now is that the reasons why, let's say, Russians are unfit or used to be unfit are different than the reasons why the Americans are now unfit. And it's not just Americans. It's everybody. It's the British, the French, the Germans, all of them. Is that there is not enough, let's just say, people don't really want to go to the military, but those who do, it's not so they can end up maybe on a doing some low profile work. They will never probably less likely to go into the elite forces, and all these elite guys, they're retiring now. And what's going to happen when you don't have any more Navy SEALs or you, so maybe you're going to have Marines, but they people now saying, well, those Marines are actually happens to be they have a very noticeable substrate among them who are Hispanic. Well, that's actually quite telling that these are young men who are fit and they are willing to die for the United States. Now, this is different for whites. Whites are unfortunately becoming less fit. They are becoming older. There are less, fewer kids that are growing up to replace the leaving cohort of the military. And you need to understand, military, they retire very fast, like the football, like soccer players. They retire really, really fast. So you can expect 10 years of career, 15 years maybe, but then you become a general and all this paper pushing, pencil pushing, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you need these young people who are fit, who play the college football or who play the they play baseball, who are athletic, or who can be trained. And now you see the problems that chronic issues, diabetes, heart issues, not just because of the jab, not just because of this vaccine, so-called. It's not just that. It's all across the board for various reasons. And the things that are being witnessed more and more as well is that growing automatization of the military, which is the only solution so far. That means drones. That means that you will need to have 40 people instead of 40,000 to operate a battalion or something. I don't know, operate an army, right?
So that gets into the whole post-scarcity thing, where things are everything's automated, so there are increasingly few jobs left for human beings to do. So there's increasingly little for human beings, fewer ways for people to actually have lives.
Yes, thankfully, I believe there are solutions to this, but it's too long for me to list whatever. I mean, some people talk about UBI, the Universal Basic Income.
Yeah,
maybe not. I don't know. I'm not going to go into that. It's a big topic, but I'm just going to say the automation in general is something that is being very, very heavily pushed everywhere. And look, I'm sort of an insider on these big corpos, because I talk with different people from different corporate parts. You know, I dealt with people who deal with the consumer products, who deal with utilities, who deal with software and all that. There's a big push for automation, and since 2008, you know, lots of people complain about outsourcing, that, oh, you know, we outsource all the factories to China. Yeah, there is truth to that. There is definitely the big problem that production has been outsourced. But this has been going on since the 90s. I remember everything was made in China. Everything was made in China when I was a kid. It's something much more fascinating happened since 2008, that all the white-collar jobs were outsourced to India, to Philippines. Right, to all these countries with an insanely low income rate. Why is that? Because now these big corporations can no longer afford paying money to Americans, to the Brits, to the French, and so on. They need to find some replacement, and they found the next best thing to perfect, and that was India and the Philippines, because those are English-speaking countries generally, and they have very low cost of labor. So big outsourcing is still going on, and the problem will start when the living standards in these countries go up. Now, that's a different topic, but it's generally relates to what was mentioned, that the military is not expanding. And some people say, well, we need a national service. Fine, have it. Have it tomorrow. Let's see how many men, first of all, will be willing to go to the military and how many will be fit. You won't see a lot of people. I can assure you that. And then consider, okay, why don't we go and enlist women? Well, that's going to be even worse, right?
Yes, yes. And we know that because it does lead to declining standards, because they have to lower the standards so that women can pass the tests, whereas men are, you know, more physically strong. Because another aspect of this is that I think men increasingly don't want to go into the military because they don't have that impetus to protect their countries anymore. Whereas 50 years ago, men around the West were generally quite patriotic, attached to their countries, and would want, it wouldn't offend them to think that they should defend their nation, and they should go into the military so that they can train, so that they'll be able to defend their nation. Nowadays, I think people are much less attached to their nations, for understandable reasons as well, for good reasons as well as bad reasons. People are less attached to their nations. And so why would they go into the military to defend those and risk life and limb to defend those countries?
No, you're right. And another thing you need to understand, well, that everybody needs to understand, is that when you go to the military, you become the government's bitch. And that means that you don't want to take a job if you're in the military, you're going to get fucked. That's the end of the story, basically, for the military, because you are the property of the government for a certain amount of years if you sign that contract. And sometimes I heard stories, like in Russia, sometimes you sign the contract under duress, right? So they need you to sign the contract if they think you're fit, and then they will force you to do that. So if it comes to this, you basically end up with a military of slaves. And we all know that what happened with that. The Soviet Union, horrible, insane loss of 1941. The only reason it was basically bailed out by Roosevelt was because they allowed them to take all the support without any follow-up on the on the payment. Unlike Britain, by the way, which FDR basically told them, you have to ship all the gold to us from South Africa, or we ain't going to help you. So Lend-Lease was basically a program to extort the British Empire so that it's going to get destroyed, because the Americans and the FDR, all these, the elites of the Washington, D.C. and New York, they hated the British Empire. They all wanted to see, I'm speculating, but FDR probably wished to see something like the worldwide Soviet Union, but not the Soviet in the sense of this disgusting hellhole of labor camps. No, he wanted to see something nice, this great paradise
more like Klaus Schwab kind of thing.
Yeah, because look, these people have had a vision. We shouldn't say all these people are evil because they we see them as such. No, they don't think of themselves as evil. They think they're doing something good. This is the problem of the relativity of evil. But you know, when it comes to military service, you become a slave to the system. You become so enslaved that recently they've been talking about suspending pensions for veterans in the United States who don't want to take this experimental death juice, whatever you may call it, vaccine, so-called, right? Think about it. It's a very dangerous slippery slope. Once that happens, all these veterans who are already on life support, literally sometimes, because I remember in 2000, early 2010s, there was a big scandal with the Veterans Affairs, where it turns out they used hardware from the 70s to keep records for the veterans. There's all sorts of issues with veterans in general. And you see, look, if you want to go to the military, you have to accept several facts. First of all, you are probably going to get to see a lot of gory shit. And you're going to get to die for things that aren't worth dying, or get have to risk life and limb for things that aren't worth risking. Not your country. Yeah, Afghanistan was for nothing. It was just a PR stunt to keep the image that George W. Bush did something. right? Same with Iraq. Like, oh yeah, we're finally fighting this evil dictator from our like 1980s TV shows. Again, for nothing. Literally for nothing. Some say it was for oil. Schizos say that it was for the Stargates and Babylon. Whatever. I mean, it was just for PR, right? Nothing to do with any conspiracy. Yeah. They did it because they had to do something. Remember Tony Blair? He said, we have to fight because Saddam Hussein is an evil dictator. He was right. He was an evil dictator. But, I mean, he wasn't that bad. I liked him, the guy. But whatever. That's not the reason why all these wars are being fought. The reason why they're being fought is because all these politicians need to show something. Same reason why the Falklands War happened. The Argentinian idiots invaded the Falkland Islands thinking that the British will not protect them, because the same mistake that the British, the Americans did in Korea in 1950, that they were not showing resolute sign of a resolute will to defend their area of interest. So Americans, I think, in the 1980s, they were hoping that, okay, we will mediate between the Brits and the Argentinians, and they will come to some sort of a compromise. Yeah, exactly. Compromise. But what happened is that the Argentinians started getting mixed signals from the Brits, and that ended up in a victorious, absolutely gorgeous victory for the Thatcher, who was, I believe, she was facing a big issue domestically, that her deregulation policies were not met with much kindness, unfortunately. But regardless, that war saved her reputation as this hero for the liberty, for this center-right conservative movement to defeat dictatorships all around the world, be it in Latin America or the Soviet Union. So Reagan, Thatcher became these amazing symbols of the 1980s, resolute stand towards against these dictatorships all across the world. Now, this was a pre-internet era, and now things are being seen that aren't usually seen. Usually we see things, used to see things through the eyes of the, through our eyes watching a TV set. But now it's not as easy. So that's one of the explanations why politicians are going crazy. Not literally, but sort of they're feeling that they have to do something more and more, because now everything they say is not just being broadcasted, it's being recorded. Everything has been archived. Everything is being read online, and people are discussing it. And it's the same problem in the marketing sciences that we're facing. That why did we didn't manage to predict that Trump will win in 2016? Because everybody was so confident, and everybody was getting mixed signals from the public.
And the media were also same thing with that as well. The media were of a completely different mind from the general public, and they couldn't believe it when Brexit was voted for and when Trump was voted into office. I think the media were really taken aback by that. They were very surprised because they're so detached.
Yeah, and it's not just the media; it's the methodology of the public. Public polls, how they do it, how they structure the population or the sample of population to study the demographics and the opinions. And then the question is, are the people you ask questions lying, or are they telling the truth? Because it used to be that everything was anonymous, that or people were much more confident that they're not going to be bothered for the answers they give. Now there's this worm in their head saying, okay, will this come back to bite me? Well, if it will, then I'm not going to tell the truth. Same thing happened in Russia, like even earlier than that. In Russia, there's a joke. So do you approve of President Putin? Or it was like, so are you going to vote for Putin? And the answer would be, yes, I will, or no, I will. That basically is the point. So that depends on how you structure the question. You can say either yes or no, and it will be basically the answer that you want. So the lesson from this is that you cannot rely on these methodologies from 1950s about marketing and PR that we have developed in the marketing and so on. And we cannot utilize them today. So these guys, they make amazing, amazing research, but it's all false, goes to nothing, because the methodology is not being updated. They don't take such important factors like, are people lying, into question. That's why now people don't trust, the governments don't trust the polls, and now what they do? They do what they did in November 2020. I'm not a Q-tard. I'm not a big Trump fan. I don't care, whatever. It's not my country. But what we saw was absolutely banana republic level falsification of the elections. And I can swear I saw the same shit that I saw in America on these phone recordings and so on, that I saw in all these dictatorships in Central Asia, in East Europe, whatever you want to call it, right?
It was just incredible. Yeah, that was obviously a stolen election. Of course it was.
Absolutely. And look, as I said, not a Q-tard, not a conspiracy theorist, not Trump fan at all. But credit where it's due. He did good for the economy. I visited Trump's America. It was amazing. And now I just cannot imagine going to United States. It's a hellscape. I look at what's happening in New York. I cannot imagine it's the same city that I visited, really. And the worst part is that everybody's pretending that it is still the same place. No, it's not. Look at it. Look at the videos from people on the ground. All these boarded up stores, real estate for rent. That's another thing that's coming. Deflation, what I mentioned in the beginning, real estate is going to crash. Now, there are fundamental reasons why it should crash. And that has to do with what you see anecdotally on the streets of big cities, that there is not enough occupancy. Now they say, okay, statistics show this. Forget about that. Look with your eyes. Now, this is different when people say, okay, and by the way, I want to finish this. I don't remember my post. Is there a next point that we need to discuss?
Yes, there are four more points, but we can go through them quickly.
Quickly, let's do that.
Okay. So the next one is increasing regulatory pressures on the wider economy, forcing businesses to close and leaving now unemployed labor in limbo.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say one thing. Regulatory pressures involve basically the regulations required to hire a person full time. That is already a very complicated task if you are opening a business. So minimum wage will kill small business in the West, because whatever it's not implemented right now, once it's implemented, that's going to be it. And now everybody will have to go to work for the big man in the tower, in the corporation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It will kill small businesses. But of course, a lot of the what we've seen with COVID seems to be designed to kill small businesses.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very sad. Number eight, general crisis of creativity in the entertainment business across the world. No new original books, movies, video games, or music. And more worrying, this is a huge topic, so
there is
a lot that could be said, and it is a fascinating phenomenon that I'm sure will come up again in Millennial. And more worryingly, a growth of nostalgia industry. Though this is a small niche of the sector, nostalgia is taking over the whole entertainment industry, and what used to be a niche is now towering over the low-quality new productions. So please go into that.
Yeah, keeping it short, notice that we don't have any more original products in the entertainment, and I'm being very serious about it. Now, you may say, okay, it's just silly things like video games and literature and so on. Consider the latest stuff that is being released. Dune, are you kidding me? Dune, of all things, how many adaptations did we see of Dune? We saw Cyberpunk 2077, which was a big hyped game. It's a good game from personal experience, but just saying that this was based on a role-playing game from like early 90s, late 80s, right? Then we saw constant reboots, constant remakes. They're going to make a reboot of some Tolkien Lord of the Rings thing with the black people, whatever the fuck. You know, they're going to implement all this stuff. The question is, why don't you make something original? Remember back in the day, they had Dragon Age Origins. It was an RPG game that was completely out of the blue. There was it was made by the guys who made Baldur's Gate, all these, the Dungeons and Dragons series of video games. We had stuff like think about these conspiracy games, like popular conspiracy games like Deus Ex from 1999. That was completely original. It was coming from all this plethora of conspiracies popular in the 90s, and they made a game with a story out of it, which is, by the way, eerily similar to what we experienced in 2020. A company that is tied with the US government is developing a virus in China, and then making a cure for it. That's quite interesting, isn't it? So I'm just saying.
sounds very far-fetched.
Yeah, exactly. And so many original projects from the 90s. And now we see reboots, remakes. In the movies, it's just unwatchable. It's absolutely unwatchable. Everything they make since the past couple of years, not even couple of years, 5 years, 10 years, you can
ten
say.
10 years, I would say.
Yeah, ever since the great financial crisis, by the way, I would argue, is absolutely unwatchable. And it's constant Marvel remakes, Marvel continuations like X-Men and all that crap with Avengers and the Iron Man. And it's all the same exact thing. Nostalgia now, because of all this, is becoming so big. People are, since the last 10 years, Angry Video Game Nerd used to be a small guy on YouTube. Now, James, whatever his name, Rolf, or whatever his name, I forgot. So he became like a big producer, and he made a big movie, and all these nostalgia tards playing Nintendo video games, they're becoming big stars. People watch their crap because they're all nostalgic about their childhood. This doesn't happen in a healthy society. In a healthy society, you have new generations making new stuff, and the kids, they're growing up with the new stuff, right? The same thing as in the 80s. In the 80s, we had new things. We had new music, new books, new television series, original stuff.
New styles, new aesthetics, etc. And yet everything just seems to have frozen. It's really a very strange phenomenon.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on. Number 9, growing autarkic and restrictionist policies on trade and population movement. Implementation of vaccination passports invalidated millions of visas overnight, hitting legal immigration and blocking harmonious flow of labour between countries to satisfy economic demand. We see this dangerous trend in Europe with the reintroduction of border controls between Schengen states. This will only promote illegal immigration, because game theory suggests that you're better off doing things under the table in the current regime. Stillborn measures like temporary visa schemes will not work, as it only adds to the existing red tape.
Yeah, so in Europe, they have implemented since the 90s a very good system, but that system had flaws, the Schengen. So in some countries, they're now complaining that there are not enough nurses because all the nurses moved. Let's say you have nurses in Slovakia or Hungary and they don't make enough money. So they're going to move to Austria because they speak German or they speak English and they can do it there. Some European citizens could move to, I met a lot of them who moved to the United Kingdom and did their job there, even though it's not in Schengen. The fact that UK used to be in the European Union, it smoothened the fact that you could just move there and change your residence, and it was done. Now you used to make much more money. Now that was good for the UK in the sense that they had qualified labor who was willing to work in these conditions, but that was bad for the countries of origin of these people, because now they had to replace all that by the immigrants from Ukraine or immigrants from Russia. So, and that is difficult because these people had to go learn the language, qualify. Now, usually that's being easily managed by students, but now what we're seeing, there are people, I will give you this example, who work and live on the border. So let's say you have France, Switzerland, you have Hungary, Austria, you have Germany, France, Germany, Belgium, and so on and so forth. You have Netherlands, which is even more convoluted with the Belgium. So what you're seeing is that introduction of this control, it impacts the production lines, in a sense, the services production lines, that now people have to spend more time waiting for their passports to be validated and so on. The problem is these things definitely discourage legal immigration. I'm not likely to immigrate somewhere where I have to have all my documents in order and be checked, unless I'm really willing to. And it's like really the question of me being heavily invested into that trip that I'm making. But let's just say that you need to take a PCR test that will be invalidated at 24 hours, and you take a chance. You have to pay money for it, and if you're not as invested, if you want to go travel on a whim, okay, let's take a trip to Sweden this summer. That will discourage me from doing that. If it's like a business trip, of course, because everything's going to be paid by my employer. Now, for U.S. Visas, it's not a big problem for United States, because in the U.S. they have population that it can manage sort of any lack of new inflows. But for Europe, it's a big problem, because let's just say if Poland cannot produce enough nurses to staff the hospitals in Germany, Poland Germany then faces the problem of staffing because all the German nurses are leaving. Now, if Poland faces the same shortage, now they have another problem, even more serious problem, that now they have to import nurses from Ukraine, and it's much more difficult for them because they have to go to Poland, study, learn the language if they don't speak it already, and be qualified to work in the hospitals. So this same thing that we saw with the supply chains, that there was this harmonious flow of stuff to produce new things, was disrupted, and now you see shortages. Same thing happens with the foreigners coming to the country to occupy the positions that are missing local supply of labor. Yeah. Right now, some say it's a good thing because it's going to encourage unemployed people to let's say go there. But consider the red tape that is required, not just to get employed, but to keep your employment. Because if you're a nurse, very good example, you need to follow the rules, the certain conditions set up by the employer, and that involves a lot of paperwork. And now with the COVID vaccines, now if these nurses are trying to speak up their mind, or they're trying to avoid some concern about the vaccine, they can get fired. And that's everything is only adding to the complexity of the situation where it shouldn't be. These are medical decisions. The labor decisions of the employer should be okay. They should be compliant with the legislation, but the legislation is so unpredictable and it keeps adding up, piling up. See?
Right. Okay. We'll move on to the next one because I know your time is limited. Most importantly, collapse in commodity prices. Current oil and gas spikes have alerted inflationists who do not pay attention to the underlying causes. Inflation is not magic, as all prices increases have a cause. The current price spikes are a result of production cuts by the suppliers, who are too wary of the collapse in demand within the next 30 to 50 years in the West. They do expect a decline in consumption. That is why they are cutting now to reinvest profits into other spheres of the economy and diversify further. Instead, look at the industrial metals, iron and copper. These metals are driving construction and manufacturing. A slowdown in the prices of these metals means we are going to see fewer and fewer new buildings and less new manufactured goods on the market.
Yeah, the problem with buildings, construction market, real estate in general is that you cannot keep it running. It's not like software. Software you can patch indefinitely and just keep the subscription there. Real estate doesn't work that way. You need to build new buildings. The reason why you build new buildings is because prices are going up. If the prices are going up, then there's an incentive for the construction companies to keep building stuff. Now, what's going to happen if real estate prices collapse? Hypothetically speaking, it means that all the construction projects will halt, like in 2008 we saw, 2009. All the construction projects in China halted overnight and just stayed there for years. In China, what's happening is they will have a demographic collapse unprecedented in maybe except for some cases like early 1960s famine in China, but they will have a natural demographic collapse not related to any calamity. And that is a big problem because that means the declining consumption and declining demand. Now, what I speculated, and it doesn't look like anybody's voicing this concern, is that China may be faking its gold numbers. That is why gold has been on decline since August, which is coincidentally the same time when China implemented these three lines policies to deleverage their big real estate giants like Evergrande, which gotten a lot of traction recently, this story, because of Evergrande's default on its debt, dollarized, by the way. How will China hypothetically bail out Evergrande or companies like that? They will mine gold and mine silver and mine other industrial metals that they have already officially released to the market, like tungsten and zinc and so on. What are they going to do? They're going to mine all that and sell it for dollars. So they're going to use those dollars on international markets to bail out all their failing companies. So that's why I'm very, very cautious about people telling you that gold is going to explode, is going to reach 10,000 and so on. Like Peter Schiff says this and that. I'm saying, look, if somebody's trying to sell you gold, think about why are they selling it? Why are they trying to convince you to buy, to separate yourself from your dollars and buy that gold? I'm not against metals. I used to make money. I made some money on gold. That's fine. I'm just saying that whose pockets are being filled when you buy that gold? Are you sure that this gold is not being sold to you from some African country where they mine it for a piece of a box of soup or a box of ramen? Instead of getting a salary, they mine it basically for free back in Africa, and they mine it for cents and cents and cents on $1,000 and so on, and they sell it to you at overpriced value with premium, and they sell you the physical metal, not even the futures price of gold. And some say that futures price says are manipulated, whatever, but you see these prices when you go and visit your physical gold vendor. Where's the gold coming from? And my speculation was they will empty their vaults, close down the shops, and use that money to sell whatever, and use that money to pay off the loans, and then you end up with the bags. You end up with all the metals that are being hoarded. I know this is a very unpopular opinion. I know it. That I'm not trying to tell people that they shouldn't buy gold and silver. I'll tell you more. The Butcher, who is the admin and the founder of the Edgelord Investor, he owns physical silver, and he is very bullish on it. And I appreciate his opinion, and I agree with it in the very long-term perspective. But look at what's happening right now. Look at what's happening, I would say, in the next 5 years. And I'm not very bullish on it, unless there's some sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, something that investors generally do when they listen to the Fed too much, because the Fed is bluffing. It's bluffing all the time, all without exception. They cannot control inflation. They cannot control money printing. They don't know what money is. They don't know what they're doing, right? These are people who put there to be to saying magical things and to make sure that you believe them. Right. Same with the quantitative easing. They keep doing QE. They keep doing this for a decade. And for some reason, it doesn't work, apparently. Or does it? I don't know. Why are they doing it all the time if it works? That's the question. Right. So be very aware of metal pushers, how I call them. And another thing about silver and gold is that, look, gold is a chemical element. Silver is a chemical element. It's they have their uses. Silver is a good conductive. And I would be bullish on silver if, let's say, we had a scarcity of silver and a big demand for semiconductors. I think that's the case. I think that's probably going to push silver further. But for silver, there is a good analog, a much cheaper analog, and that is the copper. Copper is used in wiring much more commonly. So precious metals, due to their overpriced value, are very difficult to find to use in these very sensitive semiconductors, but the fundamentals for them are there. The problem is they're not what people say when they try to convince you to buy gold. They're not trying to, they try to predict that gold is going to go there because of the Fed. Listen, the Fed is in the United States. It's not in Africa where they mine for gold. It's not in China, when they also, I think, will be expanding their mining operations, because China is essentially deindustrializing. It's getting rid of its status of the factory of the world, and they're going back into mining. This happened. I remember this. This happened in Russia after 1991, after the Soviet Union collapsed. It became an oil pump, essentially, and now it is doing just that. It's pumping oil, and what I mentioned in the text, all these oil pumpers are now diversifying because they realize that, remember the negative prices in May 2020? That spooked them really, 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 really well. That now the Arab countries, some like Oman, they have been raising debt, which is unprecedented in some of these places because of very strict anti-interest policies. But they're making it through certain instruments that are very specific to that area. Basically, they're increasing their debt because they want to borrow money and invest it into something else to gradually, within the next 50 years, to get off the oil needle. Right? So that was my argument.
Right. Okay. To summarize then, because there is a one last question here, the only question that's come in for this. When do you, and this is obviously a huge question, but you can answer it as briefly as you like. Given these various signs of economic instability and an upcoming general economic depression, when do you think the powder keg moment will come?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, this is actually an excellent question because it involves lots of factors. So I think the biggest sign that we are right about to blow up ourselves on a powder keg is when the Fed follows on their promise to cut interest rates eventually, or taper and then cut interest rates, and nobody believes them anymore. So once more and more people realize that the Federal Reserve of the United States is in no control, absolutely zero control of what's going on, then they will understand that they can not be sure about anything anymore. This is the same thing that happened with medicine in 2020. So many lies about the disease, and then 2021, the vaccine. Can you trust your doctor anymore? No. Can you trust your bank now? After it turns out that the underlying, like the ground layer of the banking system, not just in the US, the Bank of England, ECB, and so on, all these institutions, that they don't understand what's going on and they don't know what they're doing. Can you even trust these industries? Now, you can still trust maybe the currency that you hold in your hands. That's another question. Can you do that? I don't know. Deflation indicates that even if you don't trust it, you still need it to pay off the debt because all the debt is denominated in a certain currency. So if it's a pound, British pound, you need pounds. You need someone to give you pounds to pay off your debt, pay off your mortgage, pay off your student loan, and so on. If that's euro, that's euro. If that's dollar, that's dollar. But dollar is unique because it is the currency, not just of the United States, it's the currency of the world's debt, the debt of many of the world's developing countries. And once that debt is becoming impossible to pay, they will either have to basically drive their whole populations into starvation to make sure they can sell as much as possible for dollars, or they have to default on their debt. Now, when all these guys default on their debt, that's emerging markets, sovereign bonds, that's the next big Evergrande moment. Like Evergrande is just the beginning of that. That's going to be the big thing when the sovereign debt of the emerging markets goes into the shitter. That's where the Evergrande becomes a national issue for entire continents, right? So well, I would say look at what the Fed says, but look at the reactions to what Fed does. The less and less confidence in what they say there is, the more and more likely that the biggest chunk of the world's investment is going to panic, to realize that they don't understand what's going on. The FANG, this Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, all these big companies that are the big components of NASDAQ and S&P 500 indexes, they will start losing their money because all the people who thought, well, these companies cannot sink, Google cannot sink, and they will realize that they were owned by the Federal Reserve's bluff. And then the other big thing to watch is the value of the long-term treasury bonds, 30 years, 20 years plus, treasury bonds, which are historically been going up since about 2006, 2008, in value. The reason why they've been going up in value is not because these things pay you money. They actually decrease with the price. The yield or the amount of money that you get back on your investment is going down. But the nominal value of the, let's say, TLT symbol ticker fund, ETF stock, the nominal value will go up because so much money is being hoarded into it because it's a safe investment. It is the safest investment because it is the debt of a country that has never defaulted in its history, the United States, and that's the federal government. So lots of money was being betted on bonds going down, collapsing. And that happened in a way because in 2020, we saw an insane spike in bond ownership and these federal sovereign bonds, not European ones, American ones, federal ones. Treasury bonds spiked to the unforeseen level and they have gradually declined, but they stopped declining around summer, I think. And after a small hiccup because of the taper, because the Fed says, no, we will not buy bonds because we need to blah, blah, we need to keep inflation under control. The faith in the Fed's ability to control inflation will go away eventually. That's inevitable because people will realize that they don't understand what they're doing, they don't know what they're doing, and they can't control anything. They are just saying words and hoping that everybody believes them. That's what Ben Bernanke, the former chief, the head of the Fed, said, that they was the credible threat. That they just need to say, we're going to decrease the interest rates and now the stock market goes up. They just say these things. They don't actually implement them. And that, again, it shows you that the power of the Fed is just words, nothing else. If you don't believe them, that's it. Now, the reason why they would start, they will never stop buying these federal treasury bonds is very simple, because if the nominal value of these bonds go down, yield increases, and once yield increases, there's not enough dollars in the system to pay the new investors, right? So this goes back to the issue of dollar shortage, that in the world there's a problem, that there's enough dollars and there's a big hunger for them. So inflation doesn't happen because of the money printing. Inflation happens because of the demand. Demand goes up. The dollars go up and up and up and up and up. And at one point, if the producers realize nobody's buying stuff because the prices are too expensive, they're gonna have to sell stuff at a loss, because if they sell at a loss, at least they can pay some of the debt they borrowed to finance their production, to finance the, you know, purchase of the raw materials, of the equipment, the salaries for the employees, and so on. They have to have some money left. And you cannot just sit and bet that, okay, they're going to buy either way. They're going to find some money. They're going to print some money. No, it doesn't work that easy, unfortunately. So that's the problem we're facing. Decline of the population, deflationary pressure. That's like a perfect storm. You have decline of the population, and there's a bigger demand for currency, for cash. That is something that is very, very, very scary, because these two things go hand in hand. As population massively declines, let's say historically due to famines and wars, we see significant increase in the purchasing power of money, because people leave real estate unattended, people leave the things unattended. You can just steal them. You don't really need these things as much, because you can just go find some house that has just been ravaged by plague and take that stuff. But you need money, so you go take that stuff, bring it to the money lender, and you know, borrow against it, and you know, just go and invest that cash into something that will generate more cash. So there's yeah, there is a, I would say, regarding the powder keg, yeah, when people stop believing the Fed, investors in general, and they will see that we have fewer people around and we have all that debt. There's not enough workforce to pay it back. There's not enough money generated, produced, or created through the debt. So imagine, how do they create money in the banks? They loan money. They'll create credit products, and they sell those products, and then people pay back that money. That's how money is essentially being created in the West. But if there's not enough money to take the credit, there's not enough people, sorry, not enough people to take all that credit, not enough people to borrow all that money that is being offered. Already we see a problem that banks are hesitant to lend money. And now you see that they're not just hesitant, but the actual demand for loans is decreasing. What are they going to do? You know?
Right.
So.
Okay. And one final question, and please answer this as briefly as you can.
Yeah.
Given this situation, would you recommend that people get into crypto?
Absolutely.
Right. That's
To
good.
you,
That's a good
apt,
brief
apt.
answer.
Up to you what coin to select, whatever you like. Yes, definitely get it, because the reasons are related. Financial repression. You keep your money in the bank account, no guarantee tomorrow is going to disappear. You keep your money in the I don't know, in the drawer somewhere under your bed will burn, the cops will come in, they will confiscate your money. Same with gold and silver. If you don't know how to hide it, and the best way to hide it so far, as long as you're not being stupid with it, you really secure your stuff and you don't forget your stuff, you really remember and memorize things that needs to be put, the passwords and the key codes and so on, crypto is the best thing. And with crypto, why you cannot lose? Let's say you owe a lot of money to a lot of bad people. Let's say you owe $1 million. You sell your flat, you sell everything you have, you sell the clothes, you walk naked around the streets. But if you, instead of paying all that back, you put it in crypto, they will never find it. They will never dig a hole in the ground and pray that they will find the the gold, the sack of gold that you stored. Yeah, they will never find a bank somewhere in Switzerland that has your cash. You cannot hide money anywhere in the world at the moment, except maybe physically. And even physically, the only way is if you're betting, like it's in this, in cybersecurity, it's called obscurity, security through obscurity. They don't know where it is. But in crypto, you can actually protect your funds very securely. It doesn't matter what coins you use. You do use like stable coins. There are lots of FUD or, you know, fear.
Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Uncertainty and doubt, exactly. Lots of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. FUD happening around stable coins. Forget about it. There's only one way you can hide money that is not physical, and that's with crypto. And the best thing about it, you can transfer that across borders. Nobody has to know it. You don't have to check it out at the customs. Nobody has to know you even have any. So that's why, get into crypto, learn what it is, learn the coins that you're picking. Can be Bitcoin, Monero, Ethereum, doesn't matter. Look, it's all up to you guys what you do with your money, but don't listen to the snake oil salesman Peter Schiff telling you that you should buy physical gold and crypto is going to collapse. It doesn't matter. Because all these predictions, they're just, they're okay. I'm going to say this very carefully. These are a form of masturbation. Okay. So you sit on a bag of gold. Of course, you're going to tell yourself and everyone around you that gold is going to go up to a million an ounce, whatever it is. You're sitting on Bitcoin. Now, look, I own, full disclosure, some crypto. I used to own, believe it or not, I used to own Shiba, this funny meme coin, and I sold it right before the pump. Not at a loss, but still, I'm kind of bitter about it, but that's fine, you know. Again, if you're looking for preserving your capital, everything can work, stocks, gold, or crypto. But if you're looking to hide your capital, to really, really, really hide it, crypto is the only solution that I know of. Swiss bank, don't bet on Switzerland. They all report stuff. They all. If you're a citizen of the United States, every single bank in the world, practically, except maybe for some oddballs like North Korea or, I don't know, Russia, they have to report your account to the IRS office in the embassy, because every U.S. embassy has one. So it doesn't matter if you have a cash account in Brazil or Argentina or in Japan, they all report this shit to your home country. Doesn't matter where it is, right? So
okay.
Crypto is the best way to hide money so far. Hopefully, they will invent something like this for gold. I don't know if it's even possible for physical gold, but maybe there will be some solution. But so far, that's it. Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, obviously, this is a huge topic. We've touched on many different things here, and we could expand on each one, but time is limited, and I need to prepare for the next guest, which is Jim Goad. So thank you very much, Hildebrand, for doing this. It's been a very interesting stream. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Oh, yes, I did. Thank you. And definitely visit the Edgelord Investor in the Telegram. It's a great channel. We post a lot of memes, lots of informational stuff about the markets. Charts also come in. Now, the Butcher, who's the manager of the admin, the honorary founder of the Edgelord Investor, is now busy. So not a lot of stuff on those topics. But right now, maybe I will have more time to post stuff because I was busy in the last few months. So the channel is there. We're waiting for new people. So everybody's welcome.
Okay, excellent. All right, Hildebrand Szilard, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.